Yay. It's time for me again. Me. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Hey, how are you guys doing? Today on the show, zero coverage of the biker massacre in Waco. Really just don't care at all. I guess I'm a little bit interested in how many of the dead were killed by the cops. But then again, it ain't like they fired first, so that's it. Don't care. Instead, we're going to talk about the wars. Lots and lots of wars to cover. Well, in bits and pieces here. So first of all, Con Hallinan is going to be back on the show. And he wrote this fancy thing here for Foreign Policy and Focus. We ran it at antiwar.com. Yemen's war is redrawing the Middle East's fault lines. Saudi Arabia's ongoing war in Yemen does more to highlight the kingdom's isolation than its power, writes Con Hallinan. So he's going to be on talking about that. Gareth Porter's going to be on because he says that Seymour Hersh is wrong about, well, one important thing, a very important thing. Actually, the center of his story. Now, Gareth says, oh, yeah, no, as far as the raid and all that, I have no idea what you're talking about. Go ahead. By all means, as far as I know, you're absolutely right. But challenge. The misfire in Hersh's big Bin Laden story. So our good friend Gareth Porter will be on the show to talk about that. You might remember that he had written his own version of the truth behind the Bin Laden story about, say, 3 years ago. I think 2012. Maybe not. All right, and then, can you guys hear the bird chirping right outside my window? It's kind of nice. Not too bad. Yeah, Dingle, Giraldi is also going to be on the show. You know, he wrote this really great piece here. It's at uns.com, making the world less safe. Sending the wrong message to Russia, China, and Iran. And it starts out with, he was addressing a bunch of Ukrainian parliamentarians and government officials. Really? Isn't that interesting? So that would be my first question. What was that about? Council for the National Interest kind of a thing? I just don't know. So, it's interesting, though. He talks about what it was he told them. And what it was that they didn't want to hear. Very interesting stuff. And then also, yeah, China and Iran stuff, too, in that same article. Making the world less safe. That'll be run on antiwar.com tomorrow. Right now it's at uns.com. UNZ. Uns.com. Tonight... I'll be doing Eye on the Empire with Jeff Tucker. So we'll be talking a little bit about the Bin Laden raid and all that. And then also the war in Yemen. And I guess it's not much of a tease. Like, and more. And we're going to be talking about the boom and the bust business cycle and what it has to do with the boom and the bang killing foreigners cycle. A lot, it turns out. So we're going to talk a little bit about that inflation and foreign policy. And I don't know, man. Isn't that the most interesting thing in the world? Central banking and war? To you guys, too? Me, too. That's what it's all about, man. Central banking and war. If you were to ask me, hey, Scott Horton, what's it all about? I would say central banking and war. That's what it's all about. So we'll be talking a little bit about that with the great Jeffrey Tucker, who knows a thing or two, as you may already understand. So that'll be good. Okay, my website is scotthorton.org. Hey, stop by there. scotthorton.org. I got all my interview archives there. More than 3,800 of them now, going back to 2003. That's right. More than 3,800 of them now, going back to 2003. At scotthorton.org, and join up the chat room. It's at scotthorton.org/chat. You don't need XChat or Pigeon or Chatzilla or any of that crap. Just use a plain old browser window if you want. scotthorton.org/chat, fake name and a CAPTCHA, and you're in there. Simple as that. That's pretty good. But also, if you like using them external chat and type application sort of things and you want to look it up on Freenode, IRC Freenode, I don't know what all that means. I mean, I sort of kind of have been told before, but I still don't understand. But it's an IRC Freenode chat room, if that helps you. Hashtag Scott Horton Show. And then you're in. And then you can hang out with the guys. Yeah. FBI. ATF was there too, huh? Huh. Something about Misesians and Hayekians. Yeah. Oh, I gotcha. Hey, that's funny. If only I was paying attention. What time is it anyway? Oh, good. I got minutes to kill before I gotta take a break still. That's good. Well, the top story on antiwar.com today, I'm not sure if it's really worth the top story. In fact, I'm going to go with the bottom story on antiwar.com, the bottom of the top headlines. Obama bans certain military gear from local police. Grenade launchers and bayonets, not appropriate. Gee, why does your local deputy sheriff need a bayonet? For cutting your guts out with, I guess. In a surprise move, Jason Ditz writes at news.antiwar.com. In a surprise move aimed at tamping down the backlash against military tactics by local police forces, President Obama today announced he is banning the transfer of certain military gear considered not appropriate for local policing. The ban will include tracked armored vehicles, so not including MRAPs then, I guess. Tracked armored vehicles, grenade launchers, and bayonets. Obama said his working group had concluded there was a substantial risk of misusing such gear. We've seen how militarized gear can sometimes give people the feeling like there's an occupying force, as opposed to a force that's part of the community, Obama added in comments later in the day. You think? Notice to the state, still, it's all about them. We are risking our legitimacy by pushing it too far. Maybe we should panic and scale it back a little bitty bit so that they'll still love us. And then, of course, 300 million Americans cry, "We love you still." And so they stay. The use of armored vehicles and military-style tactics during the crackdown in Ferguson, Missouri, fueled concerns about the Pentagon's program to give excess vehicles and weaponry to local police departments across the nation. You know, this is not going away, and it's such a big deal, and you have the whole black civil rights movement, a whole new black civil rights movement in America built up around this, and of course you have the libertarians have been obsessed about this kind of thing all along too, and with the rise of social media, I think especially Twitter and all of that. I mean, just imagine if in, I don't know, the early 90s, you could have shouted right back at Dan Rather, "Oh yeah, that's a bunch of crap, Dan," and then just told it straight. And had the truth right there at your fingertips. That's what we have now with the power of the internet. The people do. And, I mean, it's not worth everything, but it's worth a lot. And the thing of it is, the cops aren't scaling back. They just keep killing people and killing people and killing people. Day after day after day. And, boy, Mike Brown, him getting murdered, that was the tipping point. That was it. It could have been baby Bobo with the flashbang grenade to the face. But I guess he wasn't black. But regardless, Mike Brown, not just murdered by the coward murderer Darren Wilson, the murderer, but left to bake in the hot sun without so much as a blanket covering his body for 5 hours, 4 or 5 hours. And then they called out the 3rd Infantry Division, basically, over the protesters. And that was the tipping point. And something's going to change. May get worse before it gets better, but it's going to change. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, so check it out. The top story on antiwar.com today. Maybe there's more to it than I read when I was scanning it. Did I miss the real lead here? I don't know. I mean, it's a big deal. I don't mean to downplay it. For Christ's sake, whatever. Let the guilty hang. I don't care. I'm just saying, I don't know. You have, Sidney Blumenthal, Max Blumenthal's father, who is a good friend of the Clintons, was an advisor to them in the 1990s when they're in the White House. And by the way, he wrote really, really interesting stuff for Salon.com about the splits between the oil men and the neocons inside the Republican Party, inside even the Bush White House in, the Bush Jr. years. That I think are really worth your time. In fact, I think Max on the show one time recommended that he actually put a book together. Sidney did, his father, a book of all of those articles. I might get that thing and put it on my pile of things I'd like to read someday after the nuclear apocalypse and I'm the last one alive. Luckily, I have good vision. Won't be relying on the glasses to find my way around. Keep it. Back up. If my vision goes bad by then, I'll have extra pairs of glasses, I guess I'm saying. Anyway, really interesting stuff that he wrote there about, you know, say Baker versus Pearl, this kind of stuff. Anyway, but so he's very close to Hillary Clinton, and here he is advising, and I'm not sure, the part I was saying that maybe I missed was like the real hard handshake and money passed and this kind of thing. I might have missed the real, you know, nugget of proof in this thing, but It's the New York Times saying that Sidney Blumenthal, Clinton's friends' memos on Libya draw scrutiny to politics and business. So basically, he was advising a group of businessmen looking to get in on the action of investing in Libya with the regime change. And so most of the article seems to be about, you know, pseudo-intelligence reports that he's sending her that aren't that, you know, very interesting. And I guess it must say in here how much they paid him or that they paid him a lot of money for having this access to Clinton, whatever. But it just, the real scandal here, obviously, to me, is regardless of the very fine details, is just that you see that Hillary Clinton had a conflict of interest. That in pursuing the war in Libya, she was helping a friend of a friend. And okay, I didn't really thoroughly read the article. I just sort of scanned the thing. I don't remember finding the part where they said, oh, yeah, and these guys were paying him a lot of money. They must have been. I'm just saying I didn't read that part in here. I don't see it in here. I'm scanning around now. You know what? This is what the chat room is great for, too. Hey, chat room guys, am I missing the important paragraph in this freaking article or what? Anyway, here, I'm gonna go ahead and paste this link in here, and you tell me. What the hell? That's not the right link at all. Oh, yeah, it is. Huh. All right. Anyway, still, conflict of interest, big time. Hillary's friends, at least attempting to make money off of this regime change. Although, I wouldn't presume that that would be her primary motive in doing the war. Well, it might have been one of them. But I will refer you to some great journalism in the Washington Times. I know. Wait. It's not a Bovard column either. It's good stuff. And I interviewed the lady that was the co-author of this series. I'm sorry I forget her name all of a sudden. But she was good, man. She had it together. They had their sources. And so check it out. Hillary Clinton swore, this is from February in the Washington Times, Hillary Clinton's war on Libya damaged U.S. intelligence. That wasn't it. Secret Benghazi report reveals Hillary Clinton's Libya war pushed armed Al-Qaeda-tied terrorists. True. Not Washington Times spin, but no, actually, no, really. Hillary Clinton's WMD moment. U.S. intelligence saw false narrative in Libya. That's the massacre that was not about to happen. The fake casus belli. Kelly Riddell, that was her name, Kelly Riddell. Or was it Riddle? Exclusive, secret tapes undermine Hillary Clinton on Libya war. That was the first one. See, I announced them in the wrong order there. Secret tapes undermine Hillary Clinton on Libyan war. And this series, what it's about is how the Pentagon and the CIA tried to stop her. And you know what? I went Googling around more, and I found a Josh Rogan piece about this, too, and at foreignpolicy.com. And I think I found something else, too. I can't remember. But they paint a picture. They line up. They have a scene in the Oval Office where Obama's sitting there, you know, basically more or less at the head of the table. Not that there's a table, but you got the two couches, I guess. And he's sitting in the middle, and he's got the National Security Advisor, the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the Deputy National Security Advisor, and I guess, you know, most of the rest of the National Security Council staff, whoever they are. And then on the other side, you have the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. You have the UN Ambassador, Susan Rice. And you have the, I don't know what she was, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of doing rinky-dink do-gooder stuff, Samantha Power. Yeah, she was supposed to be working on Iraqi democracy. Boring. And she wanted to make a name for herself. She wanted some attention. And as Michael Hastings reports, her own personal interest was her greatest interest. And those three ladies, they convinced Obama to do it over the objection of Robert Gates, his Republican Secretary of Defense, who that's all he had to tell the cameras, right, was, hey, the Pentagon and my Republican Secretary of Defense have advised me that, you know what, screw it, this is a bridge too far, man, or something, right? That's all he had to say. You got a problem, take it up with Gates. He's conservative Republican enough for all of you guys. Right flank covered. And instead he did this insane war. And so, as this story in the Washington Times reported, it was also, you know, the entire, you know, intelligence staff at the CIA and you know, various generals at the Pentagon, I guess, advising the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. So, you know what? Maybe Hillary did it simply for the money. You know, one thing that's interesting in there is Blumenthal saying, oh, yeah, I've identified this politician as being good for Israel. And Hillary Clinton said, wow, really? That's great. And sent it around to all her staff at the State Department. And said, oh, so my secret source is telling me, guys, that this one politician over there assures him that he'll be great for Israel. And anyway, you know what? I don't know how the hell she's going to survive. I mean, I told you a long time ago, I think it would be Jeb, not her. I think people would be so sick and freaking tired of Hillary Clinton by the time it's November of 2016. That there's just no freaking way that she's going to be the president. But on the other hand, I guess she is going to be the nominee because she's got the Democratic Party establishment all locked up as far as business goes, right? And is there anyone really to oppose her in the Democratic Party? Any real charismatic governors or anything? No. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place. And features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code SCOTT when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C., but those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Live here, noon to 2 Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Texas Time, on the Liberty Radio Network. First guest today is Con Hallinan. He's got this piece at Foreign Policy in Focus, and it's also at antiwar.com. It's called Yemen's War is Redrawing the Middle East's Fault Lines. A very interesting story here. And by the way, his blog is dispatchesfromtheedgeblog.wordpress.com. And again, he writes for Foreign Policy in Focus. Welcome back to the show, Con. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Scott. How about you?
I'm doing really good. Appreciate you joining us on the show today.
Sure.
All right. So it says here, Saudi Arabia's ongoing war in Yemen does more to highlight the kingdom's isolation than its power. How so?
Well, what's happened is that when Saudi Arabia had this, you know, they have this new king, and they and actually an enormous sort of shakeup in the succession for the kingdom in Saudi Arabia. The designated person who would have taken over after the current king has been demoted, and the king put his own kid into place and kind of shook up the whole establishment, and then launched this war in Yemen. So when it started out, the Saudis just assumed that they were going to get full support from what you think of as the major power centers in the Islamic world: Pakistan, Egypt, and Turkey. But what's happened is that Pakistan decidedly backed away. They don't want anything to do with the war in Yemen. They're getting pressured now to maybe join the air war, but they made it quite clear that they're not going to send any troops or anything like that. And there was a debate on it in Pakistani Congress, and ended up there wasn't a single vote in favor of Saudi Arabia's request for military help. The Egyptians have been pretty much the same way. They have been supportive of the war, but they're not going to send any troops. The Saudis don't have any troops, and not certainly ones capable of fighting the Yemenis. And even Turkey, which is, again, supportive publicly of Saudi Arabia, has very much, you know, said, well, we'll support you. You know, we're firmly behind you. But nobody is out front. And so what's happened is that there's this kind of breakdown of the what you think of as the traditional alliances in the Middle East, because Saudi Arabia has been basically bankrolling Egypt, bankrolled Pakistan's nuclear weapons program, has been a major source of support for Turkey as well, and yet all of these countries sort of backed away from the Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen. And it's a reflection of a lot of things that are going on, not just in the Middle East. I mean, partly Pakistan is kind of backing away from Saudi Arabia a little bit because it's getting much closer to China. China has agreed to spend $46 billion building up the Pakistani infrastructure, and that means that that Pakistan is looking more to China than they're looking to Saudi Arabia. China's not happy with Saudi Arabia because Saudi Arabia, the standard religion of Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabi section of Islam, it helps fuel some of the resistance groups to the Chinese in Western China, and some of the anti-government elements in Pakistan as well. So it's sort of interesting. I mean, here you have this small war, because, you know, Yemen's not a very big country. And the Saudis sort of launched this air war, and then you start seeing all of these kind of traditional alliances and traditional ties and everything beginning to strain and kind of reconfigure themselves a little bit. And I think it's going to continue, and I think in the future you're going to see a very different kind of coalition around Syria as well. So it's interesting that this, you know, what is really relatively of a small war, has sent pretty powerful reverberations throughout the region and even to a certain extent throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. And now, so, I mean, it sounds like you're saying a big part of this is just because the Saudis, the new guy, didn't really think this through, I guess, what was going to happen,
right? Well, he announced that Pakistan was part of the coalition without asking the Pakistanis, which is really not a really good idea. The other side of it is that the militaries in Turkey and Egypt and Pakistan, and particularly Pakistan, which has a really quite experienced military because it's fought several wars with India and is fighting an ongoing war in North Waziristan and South Waziristan. They saw what the Saudis were doing, and the Saudis essentially said, what we're going to do is we're going to use air power to force the Houthis, which is the major insurgent group in Yemen, to give up their weapons, accept the old president of Yemen that they overthrew back into power, and essentially surrender. Well, any military worth its salt knows that there's no such thing as an air war that can get anybody to do anything unless it's accompanied with ground forces. And the Saudis don't have any ground forces, certainly not ones capable of fighting the Houthis. The Pakistanis aren't going to give them up. They've got their hands tied up in North Waziristan, and they're also concerned about India. Egypt has a big army, but they're right now concentrating on the insurgency in Sinai, and the Turks are concentrating on Syria. So they looked at what the Saudi plan was, and they said, this is not doable. We don't want anything to do with this. This looks like an endless quagmire, and you know, we're not going to go along with it. So it's very interesting because the new Saudi leadership has really set, you know, they've kind of put their reputation on the line in Yemen. And that's not a war that you can win. I mean, there are a couple of countries in the Middle East, in the world, that it's a very good idea not to try and invade. One of them is Afghanistan, one of them is Iraq, and one of them is Yemen. And for pretty much the same reason, because in all three of those countries, there's no one center of power that can dominate for any period of time. So if you go in and you favor one side over the other, in the long run, that's going to fail. There has to be internal political compromise and sort of coalition style government in all three of those countries. And, you know, you take a look at the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan or the Russian invasion of Afghanistan or the Greek invasion of Afghanistan, no matter how you go back. They were all largely failures for that reason. There just is no center in those countries. And in the case of the Houthis, who are in Yemen, who have ties to Iran, because the Houthis are also Shiite, kind of Shiites, variety of Shiites, which the Iranians are. If you take a look at the Houthis, even though they're a minority, they're like a third of the country. I mean, the country has like 24 million people, between 24 and 25 million people, and there's about 8 million Houthis. So the Houthis can't conquer the country, can't dominate the country. But on the other hand, you can't fight one-third of the population and hope to suppress it, particularly when they're extremely well-armed and probably the best-trained military force in the Arabian Peninsula.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, hold it right there. The drums mean we got to take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Con Hallinan. I got a bunch more questions about the war in Yemen. Right after this. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Thanks, guys. Welcome back. I was sitting here making a bumper sticker about out of what the Pope said about the military-industrial complex the other day. That was pretty cool, huh? That was pretty cool, man. Never heard a Pope say something like that before. All right. Anyway, talking with Con Hallinan. And he's got this piece. We're running it at antiwar.com. It's from Foreign Policy in Focus originally here. Yemen's war is redrawing the Middle East's fault lines by Con Hallinan. And now, so pardon me for being so cynical and conspiratorial, Con, but don't the Saudis and the Turks, in fact, have ground forces in Yemen? And aren't they called Al-Qaeda, just like they're called al-Nusra in Syria?
Well, certainly, you know, it's very interesting because in theory, of course, the Saudis and the Turks are both opposed to al-Qaeda because al-Qaeda considers the Saudi regime and the Turkish regime essentially to be the enemy. I mean, they're not really serious, you know, followers of Islam, etc. But of course, the Turks and the Saudis are supporting the al-Qaeda people in the Syrian civil war. They're opposing those groups in Iraq. And as far as Yemen goes, I don't think you have to be cynical here. Attacking the Houthis is giving aid and comfort to al-Qaeda because the Houthis are the major military force that opposes al-Qaeda in Yemen, and the group is called al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. The major military challenge to al-Qaeda in the Islamic Peninsula are the Houthis. So here you have the Turks and the Saudis supporting al-Qaeda in Syria, sort of splitting in the case of Iraq, just not really doing very much, and then opposing al-Qaeda in Yemen, but attacking al-Qaeda's major, you know, sort of major nemesis. So I don't know if you want to use the term cynical, but it's sort of like very bad acid, something like that.
Yeah. No, it's a problematic problem, I'll tell you. You know, they were saying that in Mark Perry's article, the generals were saying, well, geez, we're, you know, McCain complains we're flying as Iran's air force in Iraq. Here we're flying as al-Qaeda's air force. And they've got something to show for it, right? They've taken an airport and an oil refinery. They've done a massive prison break, supposedly. They took one of these port towns anyway, not Aden, but...
No, but they took one. They took another major port town. You're absolutely right.
So it's not just kind of theoretically like, yeah, no, really, they're making major gains. And,
yes,
and really,
they are.
Who the hell is going to drive the Houthis out of Sana'a anyway? It's either impossible or it'll be al-Qaeda with America and Saudi flying as their air force.
And even then, you know, it would be a fool's errand. The Houthis have fought, I think this is their fourth war in the past 2 decades with the central government. And the area that the Houthis are sort of native to is northern Yemen, and particularly sort of northwest Yemen. And if you look on a map, northwest Yemen is mostly mountains. And the Houthis are mountain people. The last time somebody really tried to take on the Houthis in their own territory was back in the 60s when the Egyptians sent 70,000 troops into the area. They ended up with 10,000 casualties and getting defeated. I mean, this is, you know, this is really not a place you want to fight a war. But it shows how completely crazy things are at this point. Now, I will say this. The Obama administration is supporting the Saudi attacks on the Houthis. They are supplying intelligence. They are engaging in air refueling. They have supplied the Saudis with ammunition, resupplying ammunition, parts for airplanes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, the Obama administration is convinced that what the Saudis are doing is crazy and not sustainable. And they can't, they sort of can't win this war. It's also creating an incredible humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Yemen imports about two-thirds of its food. I mean, basically all of its wheat and rice is imported into Yemen. The Saudis have a blockade, both air and sea, and so none of that is none of those supplies are getting in, let alone medicine, etc. So you have this incredible humanitarian crisis, which is also coupled with a widespread shortage of water in Yemen as a whole, particularly in North Yemen. So here you have the administration is backing the Saudis, and you just have this incredibly disastrous humanitarian crisis developing. I mean, people are worried. I saw today, yesterday, that the Europeans decided they were going to kind of send their navies out to stop all these immigrants coming into Europe. Well, most of the immigrants are the result of Western policy in Libya, in Yemen, in Somalia, et cetera, Central Africa, Mali, et cetera.
Yeah, the Syrians, if they could get there.
And then you get these big waves of immigrants. You say, where are these immigrants coming from? Well, you smash up their countries. Guess what? People are going to leave, and they're going to go someplace.
Right. And now, so part of this, too, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but I think it's kind of important that right now we're fighting to reinstall a guy that is the new sock puppet that replaced the last sock puppet, who is now the leader, or at least allied with the Houthis, who have now taken over.
Yeah, well, sock puppet is very good. The guy who's the president who got thrown, the guy you're talking about is Saleh. He was the former president for, 21 years or something like that, or more. And he's now allied with the Houthis, even though three of those wars that the Houthis fought were against him. So just to show you,
well, and he is
a Zaidi,
they say. Yeah.
And the guy who's the current president was elected in an election in which there was no opposition. And what happened was that when Saleh was forced out, there was an organization that was really very broad-based in Yemen. It included Houthis. It included the separatists, some of the separatists in the south, and a kind of wide variety of people. And they formed a Congress. And the idea what they were going to do is that they were going to set up and establish an interim government until they could have a constitution. Well, what happened was the Saudis and the Americans sabotaged the operation and took this guy who was the vice president, a former major general, essentially made him president, then set up an election in which he was the only candidate. Mm-hmm. So the idea that the Houthis have overthrown the elected government of Yemen, well, only if you consider the fact that the guy was in there because the Saudis and the Americans manipulated him into the position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's really, I think, important for people to understand that in the context of the 2011 breakout of the Arab Spring, which was, of course, anti every American-backed sock puppet dictator in the region. And so Saudi and America quickly reacted. They hijacked and co-opted the one in Libya and did the same thing in Syria against expendable Gaddafi and enemy, supposedly Assad. But then in the rest of the region, they immediately did everything they could to wage a counter-revolution and make sure that it would go nowhere and, you know, undid the results of the elections in Egypt, clamped down in Bahrain, and then they did this maneuver that you just described in Yemen. If the people of Yemen are going to rise up together and say, we want to end this dictatorship, well, we'll give you the next dictator then. What they wish they had been able to do in Egypt the first time.
Absolutely. And you know, the Saudis, what the Saudis have been doing is that they have been financed. They are terrified by the idea of this, of the Arab Spring, because, you know, they're a monarchy. They basically finance the military coup against the Morsi, the Islamic Brotherhood government in Egypt. They financed the coup, and then they have been pouring money into to Egypt to continue to, you know, to make certain that the military dictatorship continues. The U.S. initially cut arms to Egypt. Now they, of course, reinstated everything. So, really, I guess the last standing, you know, effect of the Arab Spring is Tunisia, and that has a democratically elected government, and that's where it began. But between the Americans and the Saudis, and the militaries in Egypt, what you've had was that the Arab Spring was smothered. Do I think it's going to stay smothered forever? No, because, you know, you have a very unstable situation. Even in Saudi Arabia, you know, 70% of the Saudi population is under 30 years of age, and they don't have jobs for them. They buy off people by giving them, you know, minimum, you know, living expenses, and a lot of stuff is free and everything like that. But, you know, oil is going down. Oil supplies are draining out. 20, 30 years from now, the Saudis are not going to have that kind of money. So I think what you're seeing is that for the time being, the Arab Spring has been smothered. In the long run, I don't think that that's going to be the case, because the conditions that led to it, inequality, poverty, unemployment, particularly youth unemployment, all of that stuff, it hasn't gone away. In fact, it's gotten worse. So, you know, it's out there. And I think one of the even though Egypt, the military has taken over in Egypt, I don't think people are going to forget that at one point, millions and millions of people poured into the streets in Cairo and Alexandria and Suez, etc., and overthrew a dictatorship and established at least a partial democracy. And I don't think people are going to forget that. So I tend to be an optimist in the long run. But right now we have a crisis in Yemen. You have a humanitarian situation which is just completely out of control. And you know, that the U.S. has remained silent in the face of this humanitarian crisis is just shameful, absolutely shameful. I mean, this is a country that talks about the humanitarian crisis in the Ukraine and talks about the humanitarian crisis in Syria, and has been absolutely silent on the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, which is as serious as all of those others, much more so than in the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. All right, and in fact, now I kept you over time here, but so let me ask you one more question. As long as I got you, if you got a sec.
Sure.
Wall Street Journal said that America's picking the targets for the Saudis, and then I thought I knew this, but maybe I was only just assuming that our AWACS and our battleships are commanding, controlling the entire war there. Because the Saudis, they may be able to fly jets, but they can't coordinate an entire air war. That's the Americans doing.
No, I think that's true. I think our AWACS and also our satellites. We have admitted that we're giving them targeting intelligence. Well, if you're giving them targeting intelligence has to be sort of instant, and that's with AWACS. And it's with, you know, we have the Fifth Fleet in that region. It's based in Bahrain.
But so, in other words, though, America is running this war.
America's a big part of it. Absolutely a big part of it. Even though at the same time, the administration is quite clear that they're not comfortable with what's going on, because they don't think an air war can do the job. And it can't. I mean, look at what happened in Iraq. They lost Ramadi. Why did they lose Ramadi? Because they said, you can only use the Iraqi army, you can't use the Shia militias, and we'll do it with air power. Well, Ramadi fell because a sandstorm grounded the air power. Air power does nothing unless it has coordinated forces on the ground. So, you know, all you're going to do is you're going to kill a lot of Yemenis, and you're going to be, and you're creating this incredible humanitarian crisis, and those people are going to leave Yemen, and they're going to come someplace. And where they're going to go is Italy and France and Germany and Greece and Spain, you know, wherever they can make a living.
Yeah, a chance at a better life because we made their lives so miserable. Where
that's right.
All right, I'm sorry, we got to go, but thanks so much for coming back on the show,
anytime,
Con. Great
Scott.
To talk to you.
Thank
right.
you.
All right, y'all, that's Con Hallinan. He's at Foreign Policy and Focus, and we reprint pretty much all their stuff at, well, no, I don't know, but a lot of their stuff at antiwar.com, and including this one at original.antiwar.com/Hallinan. It's Yemen's War is Redrawing the Middle East's Fault Lines, and we'll be right back with Gareth in just a sec. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next one is June 13th in Denver. It's just $5 if you sign up now at taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
Ow, my freaking ears.
LRN broken and then fixed again just in time. Hope you guys are still there. Can you hear me? All right, good. Hey, check it out. I got Gareth Porter on the line. And he's got one criticizing Seymour Hersh's new article. It's at Truth Out. It's called The Big Misfire. Nope. It's called The Misfire in Hersh's Big Bin Laden Story. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Scott. Glad to be back.
I mention that you wrote a book called Manufactured Crisis about how the Iranians never were making nuclear weapons and how all the information otherwise is all a bunch of hype and or lies and how people just don't need to really worry about that? Because you did. It's a very good book.
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah.
No, you hadn't mentioned that, but now you have.
Yes. Manufactured Crisis is what it's called. It's for sale at Amazon.com and, you know, otherwise other places too. Okay, now, so the big misfire in Hersh's, I keep saying that, the misfire in Hersh's big Bin Laden story. Now, there are a lot of asserted facts in Hersh's big Bin Laden story, and you're not taking on the whole story. What all are you not taking on here? What all are you focusing on exactly first?
Right. Let me just begin by sort of putting this whole my article in perspective, which has to start with Cy Hersh and my understanding, my view of Cy's work. I mean, you know, I have to begin by saying that I am a great admirer of Cy Hersh. He's a role model for anybody who's interested in investigative journalism in this country or any country for that matter. He's a man of integrity, and he's a man who I know very well. Not that I'm a close friend or anything. I mean, I know him somewhat, but I can't call myself a friend in the sense of somebody who is in frequent conversation with him. But I know that he is a man who is motivated by a very powerful sense of right and wrong. He knows that the United States has been guilty of great crimes over the years, and he has been doing his best to unmask those crimes, and so that's the starting point. And I do indeed point out in my article at the very beginning that he unmasks the lies about the raid that was carried out to kill Bin Laden. You know, pointing out a whole series of outright falsehoods surrounding that. So that's the starting point.
Mm-hmm. Let me say too that I don't have you on as part of the big media pile on against Hersh. I interviewed him the other day, tried to let him have his say and get to the bottom of my questions as best as I could with him. And the only reason I have you on to do this is because I know you only care about the truth, and that's why you're willing to write this, despite the fact that you have all this respect for him that you just mentioned. So that's why we're even doing this in the first place, obviously.
Let me just add one more comment, if I may, which is the sort of the surrounding concept that that I began with, which is that whether one comes to one's opposition to the terrible things that the United States does in the world and the terrible cost to the American people themselves from the left or from the right, from a traditional perspective that's associated with left or right, I feel that it's terribly important not to be hung up by some sense of, you know, we have to support any story that seems to fall in line with our views automatically without really doing our best to try to learn, you know, what the facts are. And I think that, that problem arises frequently. And I think, my view, as you, I think, quite accurately stated, is that we have to go for the truth. We have to do our best to identify what has actually happened. And that's what I did in the story.
All right. So now let's get to it. What all are you challenging exactly then?
Well, the challenge that I put forward in my article to what was in Cy Hirsch's article is that he, you know, had an interview with a senior former intelligence official, unidentified, of course, in which the former official told him that the ISI, the Inter-Services Intelligence Organization of the Pakistani military, which is indeed the intelligence organization of Pakistan, knew all along that bin Laden was ensconced in this compound in the military enclave, Abbottabad, not terribly far from Islamabad and very much a place where the Pakistani military had a lot of presence. Their military academy was there. There was a large military presence. Military intelligence was there, and so forth. But what Hirsch was told, and what he puts forward in his article, is that the ISI or the Pakistani military actually captured bin Laden in an operation. I think he puts it around 2006. If I remember correctly, and brought him to Abbottabad and installed him there. That was entirely an ISI operation from the beginning, that he was held essentially captive in some kind of house arrest arrangement, but carefully watched over by the ISI from the beginning. And that's the part of the story that I can say with very great confidence is simply wrong. And the reason is that 3 years ago, I did a piece for Truthout, which laid out a very detailed account of how bin Laden ended up in Abbottabad, which shows that, in fact, the process was one in which he had lost the confidence of the Al-Qaeda Shura, and that they had made the decision to essentially move him far away from where they held their regular meetings, so that his influence would be essentially would disappear, because A, he was a security risk to them, because he couldn't walk, he couldn't move around, they felt that they would be better off if he were farther away from where they were located, and secondly, and by no means lesser consideration was that he was advocating things that they believed were dangerous to Al-Qaeda, primarily, according to the account that I publish in this article, because he was advocating that Al-Qaeda should attack a military base which involved nuclear research, which he said that the Al-Qaeda must attack and take over, despite the fact that it was extremely well guarded and it was impregnable, according to the Al-Qaeda leadership. And the reason that I was able to put this down in the article in 2012 is that a former retired brigadier general in the Pakistani army, Shaukat Qadir, who's a friend of mine. I met him on two occasions in Pakistan, gotten to know him, and trust him because I know that he is independent. He is a seeker after truth. He spent months of his own time independently trying to figure out what happened with regard to the whole bin Laden hit, and was able to take advantage of a number of contacts that he had made when he was in the Pakistani army as a brigadier general, and had served in South Waziristan. And so some of his former tribal contacts were able to steer him to people who had served as couriers for a tribal militant named Baitullah Masood, leader of the Masood tribe in South Waziristan, and who actually had served as go-betweens between Baitullah Masood and the second in command of Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri. So they were in a very good position to tell him what was really going on. And long story short, this account makes it very clear that he was in Abbottabad because the guy who was serving as bin Laden's courier believed that that was the safest place for him.
All right. Well, I'll have to ask you why you believe that right after this break. Hold tight, everybody. It's Gareth Porter at truthout.org, the misfire in Hirsch's big bin Laden story. We'll be right back. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. All right, so here's the deal. I'm on the line with Gareth Porter. We're talking about his article, The Misfire in Hirsch's Big Bin Laden Story. So Hirsch says that the ISI, that's the Pakistani CIA, basically, in more ways than one, I guess, a lot of the time anyway, that they had captured bin Laden back in 2006. They were keeping him in Abbottabad, under house arrest there, until a rogue ISI official went and walked in and told the CIA where he was in exchange for the money. And Gareth says, not so. Actually, it was not the ISI that put him there. It was Al-Qaeda that put him there, and ISI didn't know about it. And Gareth has a source, and his source has a name. It's Shaukat Kadir, who I've interviewed on the show before. I forget about what now. Maybe it was about the murder of Salim Shahzad back then, Gareth, I forget. But anyway, so he's a former general, I believe not of the ISI, just of the military. And he's written an entire book about the raid, Operation Geronimo. And Gareth, you're saying you find his story that much more compelling. Help me understand why it makes sense for Al-Qaeda to put their boss. I understand them wanting to kick him upstairs and make him the, you know, El Presidente or whatever, without any real power or whatever. But why put him in Abbottabad, which is, you know, they say the neighborhood adjacent to the Pakistani West Point? Oh, and I'm sorry, Gareth, I hit the wrong button because I'm an idiot. Go ahead. Start again.
Okay. What I said was that that's the $64 question, if you will, that I think everybody in the news media has been puzzled by, understandably, because it does seem to be counterintuitive, to say the least. But the explanation, I think, is very clear, that when they decided, as you put it appropriately, to kick bin Laden upstairs in the sense of removing him physically from the rest of the leadership of the Shura of the Al-Qaeda, the leadership group, what they had in mind originally, at least the person who was in charge of moving bin Laden, of relocating him, was to go to a place, a city called Mardan, which is located closer to Waziristan, and farther, of course, away from Islamabad and from the military academy at Abbottabad. But what Shaukat Kadir found out from his sources in the tribal area, who were very well informed about this, is that the guy who had been the courier for bin Laden, who was advising the leadership on what to, you know, how to do this relocation, said, don't go to Mardan. The reason is that the place is crawling with intelligence people who are looking for terrorists, and that's because there are indeed a number of al-Qaeda people active in that area. So that's why the feeling was it was much more secure to move to Abbottabad, because there was no known al-Qaeda activity there. There was no there was a small detachment of ISI, but they were not really active on counter-terrorism stuff. And that was considered to be the place which would be easiest for him to hide. And in fact, everything that I have seen indicates that that was the case, that they simply didn't look, they weren't expecting that bin Laden would be in a place like that. So it was hiding him in a sense in plain sight, but in a place that was much more secure from the prying eyes of foreign intelligence agencies as well as ISI. Mm-hmm.
And then so I don't think anybody who's not an idiot ever believed the story about the burial at sea. But so what do you think really happened there?
Well, I have no idea precisely, but I have no trouble believing Cy Hirsch's account that he was simply, the body was simply dumped from the air somewhere, or just simply buried, more likely, you know, unceremoniously, to say the least. The idea of the burial at sea is one of the more almost obscenely unbelievable tales that have come out of the either Obama administration or any other U.S. administration.
I mean, really, a bunch of SEALs joshing around and throwing his hands out the window and saying, "Oh, oops, my finger slipped," or whatever, and that's actually more believable than the burial at sea to me.
It is more believable, but in any case, I mean, you know, the whole idea that there was any effort to give him an Islamic burial is just, it doesn't pass the laugh test.
Well, and you know, here's the thing. When I interviewed Hirsch about it, I said, well, you say in your article that you sure seem to say that he didn't go to the Vinson at all. He was last seen in the custody of the CIA, not the military. And then he said, I didn't say that. He was on the Vinson, all right. And I said, what? And then he had to go.
Yeah.
So he never really clarified.
He probably doesn't really have the details of that, and he was going on sort of a general say-so. So, I mean, I think that's an area of some ambiguity.
Either that or the copy editor screwed him, which can happen.
Yeah.
You know.
But I just want to say you were right in pointing out that the key problem here with Cy Hirsch's account based on his CIA or ex-CIA source is that essentially the CIA was making up yet another tale to explain how they knew about the compound in Abbottabad. The first one having been that they had been able to get enough information from their enhanced interrogation techniques of al-Qaeda detainees to get on the trail of bin Laden's courier. And, you know, I think I effectively demolished that story, and the related story, which was that they had an intercept of a telephone conversation between the courier and somebody else, which helped them to follow the courier to Abbottabad. And that combination of lies, I think is very effectively refuted by what, Shaukat Kadir was able to find out, which is that ISI began to investigate the Abbottabad compound because the owner, who was in fact bin Laden's courier, but who they had no idea who the real identity was telling people that he had made money on trading foreign currency. And so they did a routine check to check out his story, and it turned out that they couldn't find anybody who was trading currency in the city in Waziristan or near Waziristan. So they continued their investigation, finally found that it just didn't check out, and they began to become suspicious, and that's when in mid-2010, July 2010, people who'd been doing the investigation contracted the counter-terrorism outfit in ISI and said, we think you should ask the CIA to do surveillance of this, meaning satellite or drone surveillance mm-hmm. of the compound. And that sort of coincides then with the timing when the CIA claims that they had this intercept and they were on the top of the case.
You mean to say it's not true that it was NSA surveillance and CIA torture that saved the day, Gareth? I'm shocked.
Exactly.
All right. I'm sorry for the diversion onto the burial at sea. I just want to see what you would say
that.
But great interview, great reporting. Thanks, Gareth. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right. I got Phil Giraldi on the line. He's a former CIA guy, so you shouldn't believe a thing that he says. he seems to try real hard to truth us out of war most of the time, so I don't really have much of a problem with him. He's the executive director of the Council for the National Interest, and they're the America First lobby in Washington, D.C. You might be interested. Council for the National Interest, CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org, and The Interested, too. And then there's that's for the interested. And then there's also the American Conservative Magazine and, of course, UNS.com, where he writes. And he's got a new one at UNS called Making the World Less Safe, Sending the Wrong Message to Russia, China, and Iran. And there's a lot to go over there. It's a very interesting stuff to go over there. But first of all, Phil, you're a former CIA guy, so tell me, what do you think of Seymour Hersh and all the brouhaha and all that?
Yeah, well, I know Seymour, you know, quite well. I've known him for 15 years. To the point where, you know, I've sat down with him over lunches and talked about things he's doing and stuff like that. I have a lot of respect for his integrity and also for his access. He knows people in the national security state at every level in every organization up to the top. And so he's got really good access to information when he writes stuff. And as far as I can tell, his actual, you know, interviewing somebody and then writing what the person said is completely accurate. So that's kind of a backdrop to this.
On the backdrop part, what about the whole Bob Woodward syndrome, though, where then that just makes him so spinnable by his super top-level secret access sources?
Well, that's why you have to have multiple sources. And I think Cy Hersh does. You have to not go with one guy who's selling snake oil, and you have to instead do things with multiple sources. In this case, as near as I could tell from the piece that appeared in the London Review of Books, there is something like 8 independent or actually kind of independent sources that he talks to. He talks to 3 Americans that are, one of them may be the former chief of station in Islamabad. 2 of the others I'm pretty sure are connected with JSOC. And then he talks to about 5 Pakistanis of various types.
And he told me on the show a week ago that he checked the story with a lot more than that, too.
I would bet he did, because I've been part of the vetting process that he goes through when he was writing stuff for The New Yorker. In a couple of cases, I had some information that supported what he was saying, and I was contacted by the magazine. And man, they put you through the ringer. They really work to confirm that what you're saying is something you really had access to, and you're not just kind of making it up or putting stuff together. And I'm sure he does have more sources. I would not be surprised.
All right. Well, so anyway, now tell me what you think about the story.
All right. I think the story is probably mostly correct. The one part, it's easier to tell you the part I don't necessarily agree with. I didn't find any evidence in the account that the two generals who were the head of the intelligence service and of the army were actually on board with this. My supposition is that these guys, who were receiving a lot of money from the United States government, might have been kind of winking and looking the other way. I would think, having known these relationships overseas and how they work, I suspect it might be that. Tsai even admits in the if you read the whole text of the piece, he admits that there is no direct evidence for linking them to the event. Now, the other stuff, I think the courier makes less sense for a lot of reasons than the possibility that there was a walk-in. Intelligence operations very often turn out to be produced by a walk-in. It makes a lot of sense. If somebody knew about bin Laden being there, there was a $25 million reward being offered, put it all together.
Well,
so I'm inclined. Yeah.
As far as the raid itself and the generals from ISI and the military participating in it, don't you have the gigantic kind of dog that didn't bark thing going on there with not just two so-called stealth Blackhawks? I don't know how you stealth a Blackhawk, but they sent in two of those, and then two Chinooks, too. So ain't nothing stealthy about a goddamn Chinook. And they sent in two of those, but the Pakistanis didn't do a damn thing about it. I guess they were just flying really, really low. And meanwhile, when they got to the ground, obviously, local forces were holding first responders back. Where were the local cops during this whole time, right?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a question that Tsai raises as a circumstantial bit of evidence to suggest that the hires up in the Afghan military, in the Pakistani military, were basically involved. But again, that's by implication. It's not a direct indicator.
Right.
The Chinooks, incidentally, were based in Afghanistan. They were kind of standing by, waiting to go in if something were to happen to the Blackhawks. The Blackhawks are when they talk about stealth Blackhawks, is basically they use shielding and that kind of stuff to obscure the heat from the engine and the radar profile and that kind of thing. So that's what they are. But points out, he says, look, these guys were on the ground 40 minutes, and as he puts it, he says, waiting for the bus before the Chinook came and bailed them out.
Right. Yeah.
And by implication, it's a strong argument that there was involvement. Nobody came. There was a blackout in that part of the city. Police didn't come. Firemen didn't come. There were shots. There were explosions. And nothing happened. Well, I guess you could say maybe that's the way things work in Pakistan. But I don't really believe that. So I'm inclined to kind of lean his way, but I'm not completely convinced on the involvement of the Pakistanis at the top level. But I do believe that the Pakistanis were holding him prisoner, bin Laden. And I can't see any other way I put in my article that will be appearing this week that every intelligence officer that I know cannot believe that they didn't know where he was and basically had him under house arrest. And I think that's a given.
Yeah. Well, now, so, I was going to ask you about Gareth, but I guess I should just have, both you guys on the show at the same time to discuss it or something, since he was just off. I don't want to do like CNN and then have the critic of the critic after he's no longer there anymore. So let me ask you about this. What do you think about the cakewalk? Because the way Hirsch makes it sound is like, oh, this is a big Jessica Lynch raid. Basically, they sent their very best guys to walk right in there and do whatever they wanted and go. And then they made it up like a big hero tale when really, I don't know if he doesn't outright say no shots fired at all. I guess he says a lady was shot in the knee. One of the wives was shot in the knee or something, but.
Well, Tsai says that the only shots were fired by the Navy SEALs. In other words, there wasn't a firefight. There was no resistance. And that's quite plausible. I mean, even look at this. I cite in my story, even look at the events of this past weekend where there was this Delta Force raid. If you read the accounts of that, they contradict each other. I mean, basically, they're talking about a ground operation, Delta Force commandos landing and going in and everything. There were a lot of stories about, how the militants were using their wives and children as shields. How many times have we heard that one?
Yeah, it's like the Waco Massacre.
Yeah,
the gang's all
exactly.
Here. We got the Delta Force. We got the hostage rescue team.
Yeah, But then it turns out, okay, they said only a dozen militants were killed. No civilians were hurt. They were using their shields, but no civilians were hurt. Get that one.
Yeah.
And then they were saying that the helicopters were riddled with bullet holes, but no Americans were injured. Doesn't that strike you as a little bit odd?
I've seen that episode of the A-Team before, yeah.
Yeah, I saw it on television. It must be true. And so you've got these contradictory things. And then it turns out that they had air cover. And you know what air cover means? Air cover means they bombed the shit out of the target. And there was a British monitoring team that there was a press account that appeared the next day saying there were at least 42 people killed in this attack.
Yeah. So in other words, they do whatever they want and they tell whatever lie they feel like, and that's the
sure.
only restriction. All
sure.
right, hold it right there. We'll be right back with Phil Giralli with more in just a minute. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X Key Score, Boundless Informant. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betray their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something important, something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, live here on the Liberty Radio Network, noon to 2 Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Texas Time, weekdays, LRN.FM, LibertyRadioNetwork.com. On the phone with Phil Giralli, and he's got a new one at UNS.com, Making the World Less Safe, Sending the Wrong Message to Russia, China, and Iran. And it says here you were meeting with a bunch of Ukrainian parliamentarians in Washington, D.C. Is that right, where they were in Nazi armbands?
they were a pretty rough group, but no, they didn't have any evident armbands.
Oh, okay. Well, at least there's that. That's nice. They left their SS lightning bolts at home for this trip. Maybe they had some PR advice from Washington, D.C. there. All right. So anyway, you met with these kooks, and then what did they say?
Well, basically, I was supposed to be there to explain to them that why we conservatives and libertarians and some progressives have misgivings about providing military assistance to Ukraine. And I was explaining how there's no visible U.S. interest in doing this, that it dangerously escalates the situation, and a number of other things.
Where were you at?
I was at a foreign policy institute in downtown Washington, which is where these people were. They were incidentally heading over to the Hill after the meeting with me to lobby Congress. And but anyway, that their argument basically was that that Putin is a madman. They compared him to Adolf Hitler. They said this is just like 38 in Munich or 39 when Poland was invaded. And they said, we have to stop him now. And I said, well, what does the United States get out of all of this? And they said, well, you will have a good democratic friend in Eastern Europe. And I said, well, that's interesting.
They're very
anyway,
democratic there.
Yeah, you know, but anyway, and then one of the members of the groups went through this horrific account of what Putin was all about and what Putin was doing and so on and so forth. And which, when she concluded, I finally said, you know, you're basically giving me propaganda, and you're accusing Putin of selling propaganda, which he no doubt is, but you're doing the same thing. And of course, they don't see it that way. They see it as their legitimate rights to get the United States to protect them. But anyway, the point of all this was that essentially we don't seem to learn anything from these experiences where we're getting all these little dependent states here, there, and everywhere that essentially interact with the foreign policy establishment in the administration. So we're playing games with Ukraine, which is not in our interest to do, and we're damaging the relationship with Russia, which whether we like Russia or not, it's critically important for the U.S. to have a right kind of relationship with Russia. And so I said, you know, we send the wrong signals, and then we wonder why everything goes to hell. And I pointed out that that the Russians last week had the 70th big parade for the 70th anniversary of the end of the Second World War. And anybody who knows history knows that the United States and Britain did not win the Second World War. It was the Red Army that defeated the Germans. And so anyway, as a courtesy or as a sign of respect, we should have had either the President or Secretary of State or someone there, and it would have opened the door probably to be talking about issues that are causing problems. But instead of that, Obama sends nobody. He throws out an insult instead of trying to make something work. And then I said, and then I went on in the article to explain, well, we do the same things with China. We do the same things with Iran. Here we're trying to get a deal with Iran on nuclear weapons. And what do? Obama makes a public statement denouncing them for being state supporters of terrorism. Is that going to help? And it's this kind of thinking. We don't seem to have anybody in Washington who can figure out that if you insult these people, they're not necessarily going to want to cooperate with you.
Yeah, and of course, he's got to constantly protect his right flank for American political reasons and all of that. But yeah, he's playing the perfect mirror image to the Ayatollah saying hawkish things right when we're trying to get this deal sewn up. Both of these idiots.
And it's the same thing with Russia. I mean, the crisis with Russia could lead to a Cold War at a minimum, and indeed some would argue it's already going that way.
Yeah.
And it could lead to something even more dangerous.
All right, well, so now the Germans and the French went in there and said, you know, out of the way, Obama, we're making a peace deal here, and they made one, Minsk 2, and it had, I guess, more substance to it than Minsk 1, and it seems to be more or less holding. I mean, there's kind of skirmishes, but it doesn't seem like the leadership on either side has ordered a continuance of the war, at least so far. But then America sends in a bunch of troops to train and a bunch of trucks, and they say, you know, I don't know exactly, maybe you know what kind of weapons have actually been sent. They say, oh, no, we only want defensive weapons, which means anti-tank missiles, I guess. This kind of
thing. What they really want is anti-tank missiles to start taking out Russian tanks. And I can tell you where that's going to lead. And the whole concept of, okay, fine, you guys claim you're defending yourselves, I understand that. You claim you have a territorial issue with Russia, I understand that too. But the fact is, for the United States to get into this is to invite a new war by proxies, as we saw during the Cold War. And that's not exactly anything, something anybody needs.
Yeah, only this time the line is right on the Russian border, not halfway through Germany on the Elbe River.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And so now, but is Obama saying, you know, screw Angela Merkel, we don't want Minsk II and the peace deal to succeed, we want the war, so build up the moral hazard, go ahead, give them a bunch of trucks and guns and money and try to rebuild the Ukrainian military so that they can go ahead and get us into this mess? I mean, is that what the hell he's doing deliberately here, or what the hell?
Well, I don't think he's doing it. I think he's kind of holding back, but I think the pressure is again coming from Congress. Congress is doing most of the agitating about helping the Ukrainians. And
well, he's the one telling the Army to get on a plane and go over there and do these exercises with them.
You're absolutely right, but he is drawing the line at giving offensive weapons. He's blocked these anti-tank missiles that the Ukrainians really want to have, and beyond the training and the communications equipment and we can give the Ukrainian army all this stuff so that they can do like the Iraqi army did, and they can leave it behind when they flee the battlefield.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's a good idea, because that way our arms industries can just keep producing this stuff.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, I think it's instructive, the conversation that you had with these guys, where really all they have to tell you is McCainian fairy tales about what's going on here. Russia started it, and it's an invasion. They're trying to recreate the Soviet Union or Tsarist Russia or Nazi Germany or whatever, this kind of nonsense.
they can't even shoot it straight because there's no real truth to it. I mean, everybody knows they did a coup, and then the Russians moved to protect their interests in Crimea. And then everybody knows that it was Kiev that launched the war against the so-called separatists in the east before they had done anything but occupy the buildings in the same way that the Maidan movement had done. And so, yeah, you know, come on. I mean, there's you could try to embellish and stretch the truth a little bit, but you come at me with a bunch of complete nonsense. You know, I guess that's really all they have to try to make their case.
Well, that's it. And they even cited a couple times that, hey, you know, Russia invaded Georgia a few years ago. I said, what?
Yeah, no, I was paying attention then, too. Sorry.
Yeah, and then I said, well, what about the $5 billion that Victoria Nuland was boasting about to change your government? And, you know, it's like they didn't want to hear it. You know, if you want to shut out a contrary opinion, you just shut it out. And unfortunately, they were really on that page. I really thought going into it that they would be more interested in actually discussing the issues, but they weren't.
Yeah. All right. Now, this is really among the most important things in the world, and shouldn't go unsaid. I got to tell you how pleased I am to be wrong, that I thought that we would have, I don't know, 20,000-30,000 American Marines back in Iraq right now preparing for an invasion of Mosul from Kurdistan, something along those lines. I can't believe that the pro-Israel, anti-Iran, anti-Syria politics in America are strong enough to keep the policy all mixed up and divided in Eastern Islamic State versus Western Islamic State and who we're backing and whose side we're on here, even after a year of this. So I'm really glad about that. But, you know, then again, on the other hand, it seems like the Islamic State is, you know, I don't know, on a roll. But then again, as Mitchell Prothero put it in his McClatchy piece the other day, this is Ramadi is their biggest win since Mosul. And, you know, Coburn treats them like, hey, they're a state. This ain't ISIS. This is the Islamic State. And they've done it. And there's nobody around to oppose them except, I guess, as Pat Buchanan said, I guess the Turks could do it. They have a 300,000 man army, but they don't want to. They seem to like the Islamic State just fine. So,
Yeah, Turks are not going to get involved. For all the allegations that the Turks and Saudis are talking about some joint program, the Turks will not get involved. The Turks have elections coming up in 3 weeks, and the public opinion in Turkey is like 8-2 against any kind of military intervention in Syria. So it ain't going to happen. And all this other stuff is nonsense. I mean, we created this situation, and now we're discovering that air power doesn't quite do the trick.
Yeah.
Of course, we should have discovered that in Vietnam, but I guess we forgot that.
Yeah. Well, and listen, I mean, the rise of the Islamic State sucks for the people of eastern Syria, maybe more than that soon enough, and for Sunnistan in former Iraq. I don't want to sound like I'm complaining so bad I want the U.S. government to do something about it or anything like that. I almost can't believe that they're this hesitant to go ahead and put the ground forces in. And I guess it will be interesting to see what the Republicans say. They're going to have to try to differentiate from each other by making concrete proposals about what to do about, you know, Mosul and Fallujah and Ramadi in the hands of the Islamic State at this point. You know,
well,
but,
I mean, the thing is, the Islamic State, if we put in ground troops, the Islamic State is going to fight back. I mean, they're not going to cut and run like has been the experience in Afghanistan and Iraq, where basically the organized militaries in those places just were not willing or interested in fighting us. But you know, these guys will fight back, and there will be body bags coming back, and. You know, hey, what's our interest there? Our interest there is pretty hard to define because we've screwed up the geopolitics of that whole region so much that there's not really any solution or possible solution in sight.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay then. So, hell, I'm keeping you over time here. Let me keep asking you stuff. Back to Seymour Hersh and his article in 2007, The Redirection. Oops, we screwed up and we fought a whole war for Iran. And gave their militias and their factions Baghdad. And so now we want to redirect back toward the Saudis. And I interviewed you about this stuff at the time. And we talked about Fatah al-Islam in Lebanon, the Muslim Brotherhood, and other Sunni-type jihadists in Syria, Jandala in eastern Iran, and PJAK, the Kurdish faction
of the PKK in Iran as well at that same time, all to try to hem in Iran. And now I sort of can't believe that they really anticipated and wanted the rise of the Islamic State, such as it is, as powerful as it is, as big as it is, just in order to check Iran. But then again, they pretty much done it. And we've been talking about this show, talking about this on the show for 4 years, that funneling arms to first the al-Nusra Front and then ultimately ISIS by way of the so-called Free Syrian Army all this time, and working with our allies in Turkey and Saudi to finance the rise of the rebels, in so-called rebels anyway, in Syria, it's led to this, and it seems to be it coincides with at least half of American foreign policy's aims and goals, which is to go back to that Reagan policy, right, that George Jr. accidentally reversed there, and go back to containing the Shiite revolution in Iran. So
yeah, well,
maybe they like the Islamic State. I mean, I'm not saying that Baghdadi works for the CIA, but he might as well at this point, no?
Well, I think you have to look at who's actively supporting the Islamic State, and that's the Saudis and a number of the Gulf states, and they do have a serious case of paranoia about Iran. But you know, I think that's largely mistaken. I think Iran has a certain constituencies, just like you can argue that that Moscow has a certain kind of, you know, regional sway that's legitimate. Every larger country does this, but I think that it's been greatly overstated the extent to which Iran might be a regional threat. And but yet these people, they actually believe it. If you read some of the commentary coming out of Saudi Arabia, coming out of the Gulf, it's alarmist. There's no question about it. And the boycotting of our president last week by some of these leaders is sending a very strong signal. I don't agree with any of it, but I think it's there on the table. And these are the people that unfortunately are supporting the Islamic State, because they think the Islamic State is going to kind of burn itself out and do serious damage to Iran at the same time. I think that's a highly optimistic scenario. Mm.
Yeah, they're just not too worried about it, I guess. That does make sense. I mean, for the long term, that they would think that, although I don't necessarily agree with it. That was what Margulies said. I asked him, why do the Israelis prefer the al-Nusra crazy head chopper suicide bombers to Assad, who wears a three-piece suit and shaves his chin every morning and you know, doesn't fight with Israel, never really has? And he said, well, because he has an army. And they're a bunch of kooks, you know, waving an AK-47 above their head, but they'll never amount to any kind of threat, even, you know, a potential threat to Israel the way the Syrian army poses to them. And so even though Assad is mostly compliant, he could change his mind about that, where they don't really care about what these jihadis want or try to do, because they're, you know, powerless. They're basically just infantry. And so, you know, easy to take care of.
Well, and basically the jihadis do the work for Israel. They weaken the Syrian regime, they weaken the Iraqi regime, and they weaken Hezbollah in Lebanon. And you know, those are all good points for Israel. So yeah, I think Margolis is right. And then, but I would say that it even extends beyond Syria. And it's nice to have the region in turmoil, because if it's in turmoil, they can't focus on Israel.
Yeah. Well, now, so, I mean, it sounds all so convoluted, but then again, it's pretty simple. America's backing the Iran Shiite side in Iraq, but we're backing the Saudi jihadi side in Yemen and in Syria and in Libya and North Africa. We're fighting them in Somalia. And I guess we're fighting them now in Libya after fighting for them there. I guess is, you know, basically helps them either way. But maybe it really is as simple as that. This is just plain old divide and rule, and we're doing this on purpose. It's not incoherent. We know exactly what we're doing. We're supporting the jihad in, Western Islamic State and opposing it in the East because, we know what we're doing. And they think they know what they're doing, or it really is all just fingers in the dike trying to figure out how to hold back the continuing consequences of George W. Bush's disaster here.
I don't don't know. I think they actually think that they're skilled at what they're doing, and they're playing this out very carefully. But I think the actual track record indicates that they're not, that they don't seem to know what they're doing ever. And I don't know. I've been in the government, and I've been at a high enough level in the government where I know how these delusions kind of creep in, and you get this groupthink, and you get these kinds of ways of looking at things that don't make any sense. But if everybody is saying the same thing, you're not going to be the guy who's going to say, no, that's not true. And that's the way the system works. I have a feeling that Brennan was so dominant for so long in terms of national security policy that his kind of viewpoint has permeated the whole system. And I think he's the one that has kind of all these dumb ideas about, you know, what we should be doing and how we should be doing it. But I'm just kind of guessing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was kind of the story. I don't know if anybody ever really elaborated, but I think they said that this is why Hegel left, was because he didn't know what our Syria policy was.
Right.
Which side
right.
are we on in this thing? Both or neither or one or the other or something? Somebody at least answer me. And no one would tell him.
Yeah, that's right. Hegel did leave for that reason. He was just saying, look, we need clarity on, you know, I'm head of the armed forces for the White House, and basically we need some clarity on what we're supposed to be doing and who's the enemy and what's the end game. And, of course, you never get that. You never get that ever.
Yep. All right. Well, I kept you way over into drinking time here, man. I'll let you go. Thanks, Phil. Appreciate it.
All right, Scott. Take care.
All right, y'all. That's Phil Giraldi. And he writes for uns.com. This one is Making the World Less Safe. And also you can find him at the American Conservative Magazine and the Council for the National Interest.org.